Last week, we returned to the Gospel of Matthew, and we began to look at Jesus' teachings about what we would consider the end of the world. Now, when you talk about the end of the world, there's always some important caveats that probably need to be said. And if we're honest, most of those caveats should apply all the time, but there are some of those moments where we especially want to draw out some of those things. That we should always come to the scriptures with deep humility, allowing them to speak. But there's something unique about talking about the end of the world that instills within us a deeper sense of humility, a deeper recognition that throughout the centuries, really, really smart people have disagreed with one another. Really, really smart people have said things and turned out to be wrong. And so we want to come this morning recognizing that even if we have different pictures in our minds, different theological systems about how the end might happen, that as we approach the text, we want our emphasis to be where Jesus's emphasis was. When we look at the New Testament, the teachings of Jesus, the teachings of Paul that stress the coming of Jesus, that picture the end of days, what we find is so surprising that the New Testament authors and the Holy Spirit henceforth are not primarily interested in when or what it's going to look like. Primarily, they use those passages to instill within us a call to deeper discipleship, an ethical call to live more like Jesus, to live more and more ready for his return, regardless of when or what it will look like. So having put those caveats in front of us, we come with Jesus to Matthew 24. And Matthew pictures Jesus up on the Mount of Olives with his disciples, and they survey the temple and its beauty. And the disciples ask Jesus two profound questions. When is it going to happen? And what are the signs going to be? What's it going to look like? Great and profound questions. And you have to love Jesus because he answers their question. But you have to love Jesus because he doesn't answer their question the way they want their question answered, as so often he does not. And he paints for them a picture, and he gives some truths to them. And so he tells them to be aware and not to be deceived, because there's going to be some things coming. There's going to be a lot of depravity and devastation in this world, and it is going to have absolutely nothing to do with the end. There are these cycles that repeat throughout history, and they are but a sign that the ultimate end is coming. And then he paints this picture of some of the things that will happen for this generation that we see most likely fulfilled around 70 AD in the destruction of the temple. And then we see some things pictured as what we usually think of as the end of days, as the end of the world. But in the midst of all of that, Jesus' emphasis again and again is on personal discipleship and the mission of the gospel to all nations. This is what he wants his disciples to be focused upon. And then in verse 36, our text this morning, there begins a little bit of a shift. Jesus picks up the question of when. And again, he's going to give them an answer, but it's not the answer they expect, nor is it the answer that they are probably hoping for. And so we're going to just look at three little words this morning. If I could tell you that three little words not only could but should change your life, you'd want to know what they are, right? And they're pretty straightforward. Jesus boils down when to no one knows. Now, if we could only make it that simple. But throughout church history, we really haven't, right? And in those moments where you encounter people who get really wrapped up, I suggest a couple of really humbling questions that can be helpful. First, how many people got Jesus' first coming right? Oh, yeah. Not very many, right? And then my other favorite question when engaging with people is sometimes like, why do you think you figured it out when Jesus couldn't? Right? Like, we just have to recognize that if somebody can come to you and can give you a really good answer to those two questions, I personally would be really willing to re-examine my hermeneutics and to say maybe Jesus didn't mean what he said. But it doesn't seem that it's anything more than the obvious picture it is, right? When we look throughout church history, we recognize that while this should be so simple, it isn't. Throughout history, people think they've figured it out. Perhaps one of the biggest moments in American church history, and certainly one of the most relevant for us as a merged congregation, is the story of William Miller, a New England farmer who grew up self-educated and began to study the Bible. And he figured it out. He determined through the book of Daniel and prophecy charts and all kinds of great math that Jesus was going to come back in 1843. And so he began to preach and hold tent meetings and publish tracts. And people came to hear him. Only problem was 1843 came and went, and Jesus had not returned. But take heart, William Miller discovered an error in his understanding. And so the magic day was in fact October 22nd, 1834. Make sure I get the right one. But, right? And guess what? That day became known as the Great Disappointment. Because Jesus did not come. But to put it in perspective, American church history scholars recognize that roughly 1 million people took his teaching very seriously. By way of comparison, the population of the United States at that point in time was not quite 18 million people. That's a lot of people, right? Now, people bought in and took it seriously in different ways. Now, certainly, if somebody's talking about the end of the world, you want to pay attention. That kind of makes sense. But some people took it so seriously, they went and sold everything that they had and gathered on a mountain for Jesus to return, only to be deeply disappointed. Now, to William Miller's credit, he didn't go for round three. He humbly repented and withdrew from the limelight, recognizing that, in fact, no one knew the hour, right? But we see this tension throughout church history. And while we get fascinated with dates and signs, we recognize that God, in his infinite wisdom, chose not to give that to us. And when we study church history, it's not hard to figure out why. Because if we knew, what do? We make it all about us. The procrastinators in your life, right? All we need to do is just be ready at the very last moment when Jesus comes back and life is good, right? We lose this dialectical tension if we know when. We lose the tension of the faithfulness in the ordinary, but yet living lives that are extraordinary. And so as we turn to our text this morning, we begin with the deep truth no one knows. And to help make sure we actually get this truth, Jesus is going to go on to illustrate it. He's going to give us an Old Testament example. Nobody knows, just like nobody was aware in the days of Noah. And then, if that's not enough, he's going to give us three short parables, each one containing a warning to live ready because nobody knows the hour. And then in the next 3 weeks, we're going to get three longer parables, all building off of this theme that nobody knows, so you must live differently and ready now. So let's open up verse 36 here briefly. But concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only. Words that we might be a little more accustomed to, but words that would have struck profoundly to the disciples gathered there. Jesus has just declared all of these great truths and signs and all of these things, and then he just lambasts them. Nobody knows, not even the angels. The angels who are pictured as the ones who will execute God's judgment upon the earth. Guess what? They don't get to know. And then it reaches that culminating moment. Not even the Son gets to know. And there are those moments in our own minds, right, where we struggle with this. How can that be true if Jesus is God? And I was reading a couple commentators this week, and I love this guy named Doriani. And his basic argument was, for some reason, we don't ever struggle with the fact that Jesus walked places. Right? We have no problem with the fact that Jesus didn't say, hey, y'all, meet me in Jericho, because I'm already there, because I'm omnipresent. right? But yet at the same time, we struggle with this idea that God could lay aside his knowledge, yet he can certainly lay aside all these other things to make the incarnation so real. So only the Father knows. And because nobody knows, we must live in this state of constant readiness. And so we come to the first example here from the Old Testament. No one knows, just as in the days of Noah. No one knows, just like when Noah was alive. Verses 38 and 39. For as in those days, before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark. And they were unaware until the flood came and swept them away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Oftentimes, when Noah language is used in the New Testament, it's used to talk about the depravity of society and sin and how bad things were, and a picture of how bad they will be again at the end. But here the picture is the preoccupation, the warning that preoccupation with the ordinary life hinders our ability to see that there is an impending judgment. One day there will be an accounting. One day it will come. And so we hear this warning. Make sure we are aware. Make sure we are prepared. And then we're reminded that it's not an unawareness in the sense that there has been no warning, right? Noah was not just a boat builder. 2 Peter 2:5 tells us what? He was a herald of righteousness. Noah was not just there building an ark. He was also proclaiming God's truths and righteousness. There was warning, but what? Everybody was too wrapped up in their own lives to believe that it was really coming. Reminds me a little bit of the words of Jesus, doesn't it? In Luke chapter 14, where Jesus tells a parable of a banquet. And he sends out the word to come to the great banquet. It has been prepared and it's ready. And people begin to offer really sad excuses. I just bought five oxen. I need to go home and try them out. Like, I don't think that they can actually pull sleds, or I wouldn't have bought them in the first place. I have just bought some land. I need to go see it. Like, I haven't already seen the land before I purchased it. I just got married. Well, that one we might give a little more credence to, some of us, right? But like, again, these are excuses that seem ludicrous. You are here offered an invitation to the greatest of all banquets, and you offer piddly excuses. And Jesus issues that warning that we can so easily become preoccupied with this life that we miss the incredible, extraordinary gospel of salvation, the call of God that has come, the warning to turn from our sins and live differently. And so if we don't know when it is coming, what is the call? Be ready. Why? Because one day, families were sitting around their dinner tables and their house was washed away. One day men were working in a field and all of a sudden they saw a giant wall of water coming and wiped over the earth, and it was too late. Jesus warns, there is a day coming and you must be ready. Why? Because you do not know when it is coming. The only option, since no one knows, is to live ready. And if that wasn't enough of an illustration, he's going to give us three mini parables, each one containing a warning that we must live differently. First one comes in verses 40 to 42. And the warning is this: don't be unaware, for it will be sudden, like someone snatched away on an ordinary day. It's going to be so sudden. It's like somebody just being snatched away from you on an ordinary day. Then two men will be in the field. One will be taken and one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and the other left. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. A parable drawn from ordinary life that everybody would have understood. Most likely people of the same household, men out working in a field, father and son, brother and brother, two women passing the giant grinding stone, each moving half, grinding the flour out that was necessary for ordinary life. Mother and daughter, sister and sister, and all of a sudden one of them is taken away. And that language here, following on the picture of Noah, is this seems to be snatched away for the purposes of judgment. That's throughout this passage, every instance of being taken away is negative. You don't want to be the one taken away here. It's bad, right? So that's the picture of what it is. So what is the response? A present tense imperative. Stay awake, right? It's going to be so sudden, right? All the Marvel fans get it, right? In the moment, like it's over, right? Bam! Your sweat half of the people are gone. It is that sudden. The warning not to allow ourselves to be unaware. We can so easily become blinded by the preoccupation of the ordinary. I was thinking about horse blinders the other day. I was watching some news stories about, you know, the horses and the Kentucky Derby and all the races and things going on. And I don't know how I came across it, but do you know they actually make blinders for people? We can go ahead and put the picture up here. So there are human productivity blinders you can buy for people who work in unenclosed offices, right? So that this way you won't be distracted by everything else that's going around you, on around you. Like, it's, you know, like what a great thing. Like, you know, like this is a beautiful idea here. People have done it. There's several different versions of this. These are the cheap ones. You can get ones, you know, that kind of wrap all the way around and have, you know, like they'll cover up your ears so you don't hear people gossiping next to you. Like you can just be all into your screen and ready, right? Now we can see and laugh about that. But we recognize, isn't this how so many people go through life, right? It can become so easy living in our segment of American Christianity, American prosperity, to just be looking at the next thing in front of us. And again, we feel that tension that the scripture gives us because it matters to do the ordinary well. But if the ordinary is all there ever is, we are missing out. We recognize that the promises of Jesus are true. One day there will be an accounting. So we cannot risk going through life with blinders. Because the return of Christ will be sudden. It will be like some being snatched away on just another ordinary day. Then we come to the second parable in verses 43 and 44. And here we hear this warning, don't be unprepared, because it will be surprising, like a thief striking in the night. But know this, if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. The Jews divided the night into four watches. So if you knew the approximate time that somebody was going to literally come and dig a hole through your house, you would be ready, right? This speaks to us today. If we knew that somebody was going to break into our house, we would take precautions, right? Our family fell in love with, or at least some of the younger people in our family, the Home Alone movies. Right? And most people in here have been encountered these. And that's the whole premise of the humor of Home Alone is, right? Like Macaulay Culkin prepares for the bad guys coming. And they suffer tremendously because he is ready. Right? I thought about getting a video clip of a big iron just swinging through here, right? Right? Like if you know that somebody is going to come, you're going to be ready. It's simple. We totally understand that. The only problem is, we don't know. And do you know what happens when we don't know? We tend to get lackadaisical, right? There is this human tendency that says, if I can put something off till later, I tend to put something off till later, right? So I had a great illustration of this back when I was on sabbatical. Tori and I decided we were going to go out to Colorado and spend a week at Quiet Waters, which is this ministry that, you know, caters to pastors and their wives. And, you know, it was a great thing. And I assumed we'd take the van. We always take the minivan when we travel. right? It's got 150,000 miles on it. And then Tori had the thought, well, maybe we shouldn't take that because you're kind of worried about putting so many miles on the van. And so, like, why don't we take your car? Well, there's certain problems with my car. A, it doesn't have 18 million cup holders in it because it's not a minivan. And none of the cup holders actually fit the giant, you know, water bottles that we happen to always have. It doesn't have all the things that we have ready to go on road trips, like hand sanitizer and boxes of Kleenex and lotion and, all, you know, everything you could possibly need because it's ready because we drive like 20,000 miles a year. So, like, we are always ready. And then there were the things that I didn't think about. Oh, my car doesn't have much gas. It's less than a quarter of a tank. Well, it's not really a big problem. We can just stop at Woodman's, just drive past the interstate. It's not going to take long. Well, of course, guess what's happening at Woodman's? Half of their, you know, things are under construction. And so we finally get into a place, have to switch to another one, finally get the card reading. Tori's like, hey, you have an ice scraper in your car, right? Because we're going to Colorado and it's January and there's snow all over the place. Of course I have an ice scraper in my car. Can't find the ice scraper in my car. Don't know what happened to the ice scraper in my car. It's not there. I'll just go into Woodman's and buy one. Well, guess what? Woodman's gas station isn't an actual gas station, so you can't just go buy one. You'd have to go into the store and we're like, well, let's pick one up later. We'll get going back on the road. And guess what happens as soon as you get on the road? Ding, 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 ding. You need an oil change. Oh, yeah. My car's at 4% oil life. And I was supposed to get that changed. But you know what? I didn't have to, because if I'm just driving back and forth to church, I can get away with waiting another week to get my oil change, right? Life becomes so easily like that, right? If I had known we were going to take my car instead of the van, I would have had it ready, right? For the sake of my marriage, if for nothing else, right? Like, this is not the way you want to start a week away with your wife, right? We can all relate to this, right? This is not the best way to go. And so we hear the truth that resonates so clearly that we don't know. So we are called upon to this idea of continual vigilance, of making sure we are ready. And then we come to the third parable and the third warning. In verses 45 and following, it goes like this. Don't be unfaithful. Don't be unfaithful because there will be shocking accountability. The accountability that will be coming is shocking to us. We read the first part of the parable in verses 45 to 47. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom his master has set over his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is the servant who his master will find so doing when he comes. And truly I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. Finally, a positive glimpse. Right? This is finally, there's something positive in this passage. Unfortunately, it really is only going to serve to provide a contrast with the negative servant who's coming. Right? There is a master here, and everybody would have understood masters have power over their households. This is a wealthy landowner, and he has multiple servants in his house, and he needs one who is wise and faithful. And if we wanted to take the time, we could trace those words. They're words that Jesus uses over and over again to talk about discipleship, of what it means to follow him. Those are people who are wise, people who are faithful. And this is who you want to put in charge. And if the master goes away and he comes back and he finds that his servant has done well, what's he going to do? I'm going to elevate him and I'm going to make him the manager of my household. He's going to be in charge of everything. Why? Because he has proven himself to be faithful. And we'll come back to this theme in 2 weeks when we look at the parable of the talents. But here we want to just make sure we elevate and notice what Jesus has profound promises to those who are found faithful. We think about some of those images. Like, no one has any imaginary idea of what God has in store for those who love him. That they will sit on thrones and rule with Christ. There is deep and profound reward for those who trust Christ and are found faithful. But unfortunately, the steward here is not going to be faithful. As we continue on, we see the flip side in verses 48 to 51. But if that wicked servant says to himself, my master is delayed, and begins to beat his fellow servants, and eats and drinks with drunkards, The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and put him with the hypocrites. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Wow, there's a lot there. Let's take a minute and unpack it here a little bit. But the first thing I always want to notice here is Jesus gives us these little hints, right? That nobody's paying attention to at the moment. If the master is delayed, guess what, everybody? I'm not coming back quite as soon as you think I am, right? But the hints, the pictures, the truth has been there all along, right? And we kind of get that idea, again, of those of us who love to procrastinate, right? I can remember a time when I was given great privilege. I didn't realize this wasn't normal growing up. See, both of my parents were professors, and so the day came when I was in high school, my freshman year, before my freshman year, I wanted to play football, and so you needed to go to football camp. And so my parents left me at home alone for 2 weeks over the summer as a freshman. Now, when I got married, my wife informed me this is not normal, and that we would never be doing this in our household, right? But this became a pattern for me is, you know, my parents would be gone, you know, oftentimes for 2 to 4 weeks over the summer, and I would stay home later to work and to do other things, and it was all great. Now, I was a young person, but I was fairly responsible. Did I ever hold wild parties? No. Did I have people over? Yes. Was I told I could have people over? Yes. Did I make some choices that were probably not completely God-glorifying? Yes. Did I bum food off of my friends and use the money my parents had given me to buy a new skateboard? Yes, I did. I will confess that, right? There are some things I did that were not, but you know, like, but I didn't spend more money than they, you know, had allotted to me. I just found other ways to eat. You know, like there's great rationality there. You know, like I'm still kind of, you know, picturing some of these things. But to give you the picture, so my dad was a professor and he was very detailed oriented. And so back in the day, I know it's hard to believe, they didn't have cell phones. They didn't have GPS. So there were these things called maps. And, you know, you had to make reservations to go camping at different places. And so my dad had his entire itinerary typed and laid out of where they would be and what mile markers they would be passing, to such a point that when my mom was called to offer a job, we got a call. The park ranger came and found us at the campsite in the Grand Canyon to come and have my mom go and interview for a nursing job at Aurora University, because everybody knew exactly where we would be. Right? It was all there. Well, one day I got a call and my dad told me that they had car trouble and they were driving a 1985 Volkswagen Vanagon, which had a pop top and a four-cylinder engine and continual problems. And so it came to the point, you know, like they'd had some road trouble, so they were going to be delayed. And so we're going to be 2 days late. Well, what did I do? I continued to live the way I had been living. Most of us, generally, teenage guys, aren't the most neat, right? Did I eventually clean up the house? Of course. Did I use every single dish before I bothered to wash them? Yes. Did I leave things stacked all over the house? Did I vacuum with the entire... No. Did I do any of these things at this point? No, I didn't do any of those things. Well, guess what? A part was achieved early, and my parents came back sooner than expected, and they got to see the house as a complete disaster. Right? And what was revealed is what was actually there rather than the face that I would put up if I knew they were returning, right? They got to see what was really there, right? Now, was it as bad as it could have been? Of course not, right? It was not, you know, worthy of a movie by any means, but it's that recognition, right? If I had known they were going to be coming home sooner, would the dishes have been put away? Would the house have been vacuumed? Would the bathroom? Of course, it would have all been spotless. Did I live spotlessly? No. And this is that image again here. The master is delayed. So how are we going to respond? And so there's some truths we got to make sure we pull out of here. First, make no mistake, the master is coming back. Right? The parable makes that absolutely clear. Jesus is coming back. The master did return. It just wasn't when everybody thought he was going to come. What else do we want to make sure we notice? The person who thought they're in charge, they were reminded that their charge was only temporary. right? We are only stewards, and we are only temporary in charge of things in this life. Everything ultimately belongs to Jesus. Everything ultimately is His. We are just managing it for this short, brief period of decades. We draw breath in this world. We also want to recognize that how we wait reveals the state of our hearts, right? If the master had known how this servant was going to respond, he never would have put him in charge in the first place, right? So far, he's lived as a person of character, of managing responsibilities. But what happens? Oh, the pressure is off. All of a sudden, he begins to aggrandize himself, right? I love the way the text says it. He began to beat his fellow servants. He doesn't actually have any more real authority than they are. He is one of them, but he has elevated himself, right? We hear that warning. We cannot think more highly of ourselves than we should. And when he does that, when he elevates himself, what does he begin to do? He begins to compromise. He eats and he drinks with the drunkards. Whose money do you think he's using to do this with? The master's. The master will call him to account for how he has lived. And we recognize that how we wait reveals the state of our hearts. The problem isn't that the master is delayed. The problem is the servant is wicked, right? The wickedness of our hearts can so easily consume. We need to hear the warning and to recognize the deep truth that comes when the pressure is off. I'm reminded of William Barclay in his commentary. He talks about these demons who apprentice with Satan. And so they come to do their apprenticeship on earth. And the first demon tells Satan, "I will tell people there is no God." And Satan's like, "Yeah, most of them won't believe you." The second one says, I got it better. I'll tell people there is no hell. A few more people will believe you, but most won't. The third one says, I will tell people there is no hurry. I will tell people there is no hurry. To which Satan responds, you will gain many souls. We recognize how we respond when the pressure is off as profound. We need to hear the truth that we will be held accountable. That there is an accountability. And here we have to recognize the context, especially. Who is this all teaching directed towards? To the 12, to Jesus' leaders. The recognition is what? As Peter says, where does judgment begin? In the household of God and with those who have authority first in that. Don't aspire, Paul warns us, to leadership, for you will be held to a higher standard. There is no room in the kingdom of God for those who would use the authority they have been entrusted with to inflict or hurt others. That we are all called to follow the example of Jesus, to pick up the towel and wash one another's feet. There is no room for aggrandizement in the church or in God's kingdom. We hear the recognition and the challenge that there is going to be an accounting, and we will be held accountable. And then we come to that reality of what that looks like. Judgment. People in the ancient world would need no explanation that the master of the house could do with his servants and his slaves as he wished. That was the law. But it seems harsh to us, and we struggle with the language. And here first we have to admit this is apocalyptic language, right? We can't take this language literally, because you can't cut somebody in half and then still have them weep and gnash their teeth, right? Well, we get that. But we also need to not just say, it's apocalyptic language, I don't need to worry about it. It's language that's designed to freak us out. And we need to make sure that we let it carry its weight. That language of cut into pieces is the same terms used in the Greek translations of the Old Testament to cut in half an offering and place it on the altar. And it seems harsh and severe language, but sometimes what we need to do is just maybe change the picture a little bit. Because I could tell you that if I were to come home from a date with my wife and I found the situation in my household that my babysitter was drunk and gorging themselves on the floor and my kids had bruises on them and were locked up in the dog crates, I can tell you my reaction would not probably be very godly. Right? We recognize that this is a harsh picture of judgment. But it's based on the wickedness and the destruction of sin. And sometimes we forget how evil and how horrible sin is and all the suffering and devastation it has wreaked in God's creation. And then we come to that language, have a place with the hypocrites. And again, we're reminded, who is Jesus' harshest words reserved for? The religious establishment. Hear the warning, don't play with religion, right? If you want nothing to do with Jesus, you are far better off to stay away from religion, because the getting close to the kingdom but not in it is a dangerous, dangerous place to be. Matthew 23 contains what? The seven woes to the Pharisees and the constant label of hypocrite. This is the worst place to find yourselves again. And we recognize, what did the steward do? He portrayed himself as one thing, but in fact, he was something else. And so we hear the warnings of judgment, culminating in that picture, weeping and gnashing of teeth. Again, this dual language reflecting both regret and sorrow and remorse, but also deep and profound anger. This twisted picture of torment. And we need to hear what the profound truth. That judgment isn't just an Old Testament word. It's not just a bad word. It's a word on the lips of Jesus. It's a holy word. It is a word of warning. But it's not only a word of darkness. It offers us the profound hope of the gospel. The recognition that yes, we are all condemned. We are all worthy of judgment. But yet, this same Jesus who tells us and warns us that this is what is coming is the one who went to a cross and suffered all of this for me so that I could be saved from it. That the call of the gospel is one that embraces the idea of judgment and prepares us for this. So we get these three parables on the foothills of this illustration of Noah, driving home the truth that nobody knows. So what? So live ready. Live ready for now. Well, how do we do that? Express that idea of tension before, and I think that's where it would be helpful for us to land. How do we live ready? Well, first, we have to be faithful in the ordinary, right? It's a recognition that there is day in and day out faithfulness that's required. I love that all of these parables are what? People are what? They're working. They're going through all the things in life, right? You need to be in the field. You need to be at the mill. You need to be ready in your house. You need to be taking care of the other people in your life. This is what the end of the world looks like. There is no other thing than the ordinary, right? When Jesus comes back, I love what Martin Luther said. He said, what would you do if Christ was coming back tomorrow? I'd plant a tree today. Really? You know, like one of those things, like it's like when the day comes, I really, you're like, did you really say that? Or is that just like one of those things? But you read Luther's theology and you kind of like, I could get Luther saying that. There is this recognition. What? There are the things that have to continue to be done. Because we don't actually know. So is it wrong to do the ordinary? No. The ordinary is what is required to continue and do life well. Because what do we recognize? That salvation is not about instant transformation, right? It's about this progression, day in and day out, in being faithful in the ordinary. of doing what God has given us to do and doing it well and recognizing every blessing we experience comes down from the Father of lights. We need to be faithful in the ordinary. But if that's all we have, we've heard those warnings, right? There's also this call, don't forsake the extraordinary. Don't forget that Jesus is returning. Don't forget that there is a world that desperately needs to hear the words and the gospel of Jesus, right? It is a valiant and worthy thing to give your life in service of the gospel, to pick up your cross daily and follow him, to go and take the gospel to all nations, to do whatever needs to be done. And so we become people who live in this constant tension between the ordinary and the faithfulness that is called, but also the extraordinary transforming power of the gospel that is at work in our life. Everything it has done and continues to do, and the call to live in light of it. And we recognize what? Man, if we knew when Jesus was coming back, we would totally drop the tension, right? Because if I knew Jesus was coming back this afternoon, I'm not going to wash the dishes. Right? I'm not going to do any one of the numerous things that need to be done. Right? There are so many things we would do differently. And so often in our preaching, we want to just latch on to the extraordinary. And it's true. But we need the tension of the ordinary. Why? Because if Jesus doesn't come back for another year, you know what happens if I haven't done the dishes? Bad things, right? You can't live that way, right? And we laugh, but we recognize and feel the tension that exists there. Because no one knows. We must live ready.